up in the red room.
Before the stars can be paid, there gotta be a dope ass story on the page. Let the beast about the cage, that light about the dark. Can you build the inferno from an itty bitty spark? Coffee shop hustlers rise with the cream. A million other writers, same Hollywood dream. Your pen and paper, all like bullets in the gun. Write what you feel, say what you want in the red room. We say what we say, we do what we feel. We gotta keep it real
in the red room.
All about the crap of screenwriting. Fill my bottle up with lightning up in the red room.
So look, if you guys are grown, let's go ahead and get in. What's up, y'all? It's your boy, Hilliard Guest. I see you, Neil. And you guys are listening to the Screenwriters Rant Room, where we keep it real, we keep it opinionated, we keep it what, Lisa?
2016. Which has been a crappy year so far.
Oh, we lost a lot of people.
So hopefully the second half does a lot better. Yeah. Also, I want to give a quick, before we get started, want to give a shout out to a lot of the horror fans out there and people who really love old school cinema. The Wicker Man, Robin Hardy, passed away the other day. So those of you who have The Wicker Man on one of your top 10 horror films of all time, which you should, he just recently passed away. And Michael Cimino, too, who did The Deer Hunter. Mm-hmm. So a lot of really game changers in terms of film that had a huge impact on me loving film have passed away. So I want to make sure we recognize those folks. And also, shout out to Hollywood Forever having the cemetery. Purple Rain screening at the cemetery and had Questlove DJing. No, because it's too big. It's too big now.
It's too big now.
I can't. You can't. Yeah. In the old days, I used to go in the early day when I first started. Like, I think I went to one of the second screenings they ever had. And there was only less than maybe 100 of us there. And it was always fantastic. And I'm always excited because when I would go and I would try to get friends to go, they would get creeped out because it's in a cemetery.
She would go see the most scariest movie there, too. She has no problem.
And it's like, it's no problem because it's on the side of a mausoleum wall. You're on the lawn. A lot of people think, oh, are you sitting on top of like headstones? No. The section that you're sitting on is a really like a grassy area and it's on the side of a mausoleum wall. So you're not sitting on top of people's tombstones.
So they tell you.
They have plenty of wonderful porta potties so everyone go to the bathroom. When you get there, it used to be $10. We would park inside. Mind you, this is the old days. We would drive in. Like, we would just drive up, pay our little $10. I would drive right to the spot. I used to be in the back against, like, this. Okay, I will admit, there is one crypt.
See what I got
to
do?
Wait. There is one crypt that would be in the back.
And
I would post up against that because, one, people wouldn't be walking past you and smoking, and then you don't have to get up and move everything. And I would park my car. I'd have my wine, the candelabra, the blankets, the lawn chairs. We'd have our snacks for Trader Joe's. It was fantastic. The DJ would play music. When it got a little dark, they'd show, like, big old posters from all over the world from famous movies. And then whatever the movie was, they would screen it, and we would laugh. And it was, like, fun. And I would tell people, y'all need to come. And they'd be like, ooh, no. Now they got to, like, expand it to, like, 2 days. Sinespia has become the Comic-Con of outdoor movie screenings. Much love to them. All the people who've come, the Johnny-come-latelys, I appreciate it because it vindicates me that I was right. But they did
She's always the one who's first on everything.
They showed Purple Rain. They had Questlove out there spinning tunes. Mm. It was wonderful. So shout out to everybody who went and celebrated Prince. As you notice, I got my Prince necklace.
That's what's up.
Anywho, that's what's up.
So you guys know how we do it on this rant, the rant room. On this show, we discuss entertainment, TV, film, music, culture. But our focus is always screenwriting, stories, craft, and shit like that.
Yes. Right.
So you can cuss on my show.
Yes.
Fuck yeah.
We are on. Oh, look at that. Go ahead now, ma'am.
Yes, I know.
We are unfiltered.
All right.
So you hear her voice. That's my girl, Lisa Bolakaja. You've been gone for a minute.
Yeah.
You're back?
I am back.
You started from the bottom, now you're here?
From the bottom, and now as here. I'm off for the summer now, but I have been traveling, doing a lot of stuff, and I missed the last couple of episodes because I was just busy. Literally, I was like texting you like, I can't come. Even though I love coming up here, I just couldn't make it. But I am thrilled today because when you texted me and said that we were having Neil come in, and I was like, the gods have answered prayers. Because Neil, especially his new book, it is breaking down shit that I think especially in new media.
Nobody's talking about it like this.
Yeah,
that's for sure.
Like, in terms of, no. I mean, even Neil says, even the term new media is like almost cliche now. Mm-hmm. It's like shit that we watch and how things have changed in our viewing. Like, he breaks down the history of it. He talks to the people. And I think it's really important.
He went to the source.
Yes. And I really want Neil to break down to people, because when we talk about pitching to different places and coming up with projects, you got to know where you fit in to get in. And so many of us are fucking up because we are trying to present projects and we haven't done our homework to know what that brand is or what it is that they're trying to put out, whether you're talking about Netflix or Amazon or Hulu or Crackle and all that stuff. And Neil, thank God, has gone to the mountaintop. As Moses.
Moses, yeah.
He went up. And the Lord said, Neil.
The Lord said, come on now. Preach it, girl.
He said, Neil, I need you to take this back to the peoples.
To the peoples.
Should be my publicist. This is good.
And break it down, because you've done, and what I love is the fact that point on, this is not hearsay. This ain't secondhand somebody auntie, and I heard somebody said. You went and interviewed people. Like, I knew he wasn't bullshitting when I, like, you know, I kind of downloaded the first three interviews, because, you know, you can go on Amazon. Yeah. And I was trying to get the book, and I was like, damn it, I wish I could have got it beforehand, but I've been so busy. But then when I read the first person he interviews in the book, y'all want to know, fam? Y'all want to know who it is? Tom Fontana. If you don't know who, look, if you don't know,
straight to the mountaintop.
If you don't know who Tom, if you don't know what a, like, the old school term game changer, if you don't know who Tom Fontana is, baby, you haven't done your homework and research.
What do we always say? Google him, bitch.
Google him, bitch. Yeah, yeah. And I was like, he is like breaking shit down. So I'm so thrilled for you to be here, Neil, because you have a lot of information that I think is going to help a lot of writers, newbies and oldies, to kind of understand what we're dealing with now in terms of trying to get product and content out, because it has changed. Like, in your forward, you talked about how when you were a kid back in the old days, when we had three networks, bitch, let me tell you, they had us under mind control.
They did.
Like, if you want to see a show, it wasn't like you can go look at it later or go online or whatever. Your ass had to be sitting there with your snacks. You had to watch it. And if you, there are times
and
when
the
I
commercials,
would, like,
bitch.
Oh God,
and the commercials.
There were times when I would weep because we'd be come home from somewhere and there'd be an episode of Joni Loves Chachi on. And my mama was taking too long to get shit done. And I would get in and I would have to wait like maybe a whole year in the summer, maybe if they did reruns or whatever.
Right.
And I just thought to myself, he remembers the days of the rabbit ears, the pliers. So I got a little nostalgic reading the forward. And I thought, well,
let
thank
me set
God,
him up, David. Let me set him up.
Someone is here to save us.
That's what's up. So you can't beat that intro, David.
No, that's the best intro I've ever had.
That's
thank
what I'm talking about. Shit. She dropped some bombs on you. She would just freestyle.
Like,
on
I
you
love how many people do the work and you don't have to. I don't have time to teach a lot of stuff to people. I just want to be able to say, here's a source. Do your research, bitch. Do your research.
What else is up? So we got my man here today. Award-winning writer, producer, author, instructor, director of the UCLA program. Which one is
yeah,
it?
Yeah, now I'm running the MFA in Writing for Television program at UCLA.
You gotta be somebody.
Wait.
You gotta be somebody.
He just says it like it's like, yeah, well, like, you know, I work at Starbucks. And, you know, I'm just kind of doing
I'm
something.
I'm a barista and I run the program. Well, you know, when I'm an alum from UCLA Film School, and it really was a film school when I went there. Yeah. We didn't even have TV classes. So when I finished in the 80s,
Neil Landau, by the way, I didn't get that out.
I used to write with a writing partner, and she was an English major. And so when I graduated, we used to write 3 days a week on our spare time while we were doing our day jobs and finishing our degrees. And we wrote a spec script. We wrote several, but the third one we wrote became Don't Tell Mom the Babysitter's Dead.
Yeah,
Applegate. So I went right into movies, but that screenplay, which was written on spec, while we were waiting to see if it was going to get made or not, because we sold it, but then it was originally developed for Justine Bateman, who was on Family Ties at the time.
Oh, my God,
I mean, there were so many drafts, and then it went into turnaround, so 20th Century Fox ended up buying it, but they decided not to make it, and then it sat for a while, and then HBO and Warner Brothers made it when we got Christina Applegate, and the rest is history there. Okay. But that screenplay got into the hands of Stephen Bochco, And we got...
Who's that? I don't know who that is.
That's another legend. Who that is?
Because we were really young, and he was doing Doogie Howser, mm-hmm. which was a very young Neil Patrick Harris as a 16-year-old doctor. So we got into television off of a feature, which happens, but rarely.
It didn't happen that much back then, though, did it?
No.
Because they didn't really cross paths too
Not
much,
really.
Right?
Mm-mm.
No, but at the time, you didn't have all these TV programs. People weren't... Mm-hmm. At the time, nobody wrote spec pilots. Mm-hmm. It was not a viable way to calling cards. Sure. You had to go through and pay your dues and be a writer's assistant or a script coordinator if you were lucky enough to get one of those jobs, because with only three or four networks, there were very few opportunities. So you had to work your way up from staff writer, story editor, you know, executive story editor into the producer ranks. And that was the only way to really, once you had a track record, just working your way up through staff, then maybe you'd get a chance to develop a pilot at a network. But it would be people who knew you and knew your work, and you had, you know, you had your bona fides. But so we worked on Doogie Howser, which I thought was actually a really good show.
It was a great
and
show.
And got to work with Stephen Bochco, which was part of a dream, because when I was an undergrad at Cal State Northridge before I transferred to UCLA, my internship was at MTM Enterprises, which was Mary Tyler Moore, Grant Tinker's company, at CBS Radford in Studio City, which is now a few blocks from where I live. And I interned on Hill Street Blues. So I interned at MTM, but then within your internship, it was a very structured internship, which was great. You didn't get paid, but they really treated that you were not exploited. It was a formal program where you got to go to dailies, you got to go to the editing room, you got to be on set of it. So I was on set at Hill Street Blues, and at the time they were doing Newhart, St. Elsewhere, Hill Street Blues, and there was one other. Oh, Remington Steel.
Oh, God, yes, Remington Steel.
So that was just a good part of the whole education. But that, you know, so a feature got us a TV job. Then later, when my writing partner and I split up, I was developing a feature for Bette Midler, who used to have a company called All Girl Productions at Disney. And that screenplay got into the hand. One of Bette Midler's producing partners, Margaret South, was married to Frank South, who was the showrunner of Melrose Place. And she was reading my rewrites on the script, and Frank heard her laughing, and he's like, what's so fucking funny, you know? And she's like, this writer, he's really, you know, and he said, I want to read it. So that was just a lark. It didn't come from an agent or anybody. He read it, and that, after, if you write with a writing partner and have any success, and all of your works are together, when you split up, it's like, you know, in a lot of ways, I had to go back to square one.
You had to reinvent.
Totally had to reinvent. The only advantage was we were at CAA, and our agent decided not to drop us. She was open to representing us separately.
Wow.
Because it was kind of like a divorce. It was an ugly breakup at the time. Sure, we're friends again. So I was very fortunate when because I wasn't working. And that's how I started teaching originally at UCLA Extension.
Oh, really?
Because I couldn't get a job, because everybody's like, well, how do we know what you wrote and what she wrote? And everything was linked. So I had to create some new writing samples, new body of work. When the phone rang and it was Frank South saying, hey, do you want to come write for Melrose Place? I have an opening.
And you were like, let me think about that. Oh, yes. Before you hung up, you were in the office.
It was like an answer. It was an answer to a prayer at the time, because I remember just being like, is this it? Am I never going to work again? I really don't know where it's coming from. I'm glad, you know, in retrospect, when you look back at some of what you consider to be your greatest failures, because that's how I started to teach. And I love teaching, and I've been teaching now for 15 years. So that wouldn't have happened. And, you know, but part of why I started writing books about writing and creating television, and how I kind of segued into running the department at UCLA, which is now really the school of... Our department is film, television, and digital media.
And they had to be current, didn't they?
Television and digital media is now like where the majority of the interest is from our students.
Sure.
Because that's where the opportunities are. Mm-hmm. And the movie business has changed so much. Yeah. I mean, there's a very small circle of A-listers who are pretty much the ones who will write many, if not all, of the big blockbuster kind of movies. Because with that kind of investment, you need somebody tried and true. Every once in a while, somebody slips through the cracks, and, you know, we've had some of those students at UCLA just this past year with their movies, but most of the success is coming from television, and we have lots of TV classes, both where they write spec episodes of both drama and comedy.
We have a mutual friend who did she get her master's yet, or she's getting her master's?
She's getting her master's now.
Linnell White, and she just won. You know, Linnell, she's on my show all the time.
Yeah.
Linnell is so talented.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, she was already a pro when she came into our program. Mm-hmm. I mean, she was on Army Wives, mm-hmm. and she...
Z Nation,
yeah. Exactly. Mm-hmm. She's extremely talented.
Hi, Linnell.
What's up, girl?
Very prolific. You know, she was in the Air Force, as you know. Mm-hmm. She's extremely...
Super smart.
Like, she's the... I tell people, like, look, if something goes down, I'm going to be at Linnell's place.
Oh, yes.
We go into the airport, because she's going to fly the plane to get us out of here.
She can fly it.
Undoubtedly from her military experience, extremely prolific because she's so disciplined.
True.
About sitting in the chair and getting mm-hmm. her work done.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Never an excuse. Mm-hmm. You give her a note, even if she thinks it's the stupidest note she's ever heard, you would never mm-hmm. know it because she just says, all right, I'll look at that. I'll take care of that. She always transcends the note, you know, mm-hmm. she makes it her own. So yeah, she's a pleasure. She's mm-hmm. she's going to have a very bright future. I can guarantee
mm-hmm.
it.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah. And actually over the last, I guess, from the last 4 years of our students who have a TV emphasis in our MFA program, there are now 18 people staffed on shows.
That's great.
I mean, wow. Amazing. Yeah, just
that's
two
Tony
more.
The Tiger Gray.
Okay,
isn't it?
That's like
two more just got staff. One on The Magicians on Sci-Fi, the other one on Dead of Summer. Three more. Dead mm-hmm. of Summer, which is on Freeform,
mm-hmm.
and another one is on Lucifer on Fox.
Oh, okay, yeah.
Okay. Actually, you read that.
My mother loves that show.
So part of, you know, to talk about the book a little bit.
Let's tell them what it's called. Yes. Let's get it set up.
It's called TV Outside the Box, and then the subheading is Trailblazing in the Digital Television Revolution. When I first...
Do you take a breath after that? It's like a tongue twister.
Okay.
Isn't it?
It is. Well, but there's, you know, just like we're all writers, every word matters here because...
It is doing work.
Yes.
Every word is doing work.
It is because the topic is so vast.
Mm-hmm.
That I had to make it Trailblazers. Mm-hmm. And as I was researching it, I realized it was almost like, these are the people first in the gate. These mm-hmm. are the pioneers in, you know, streaming and digital.
Mm-hmm.
But then, you know, there'd be another show that came and I'm like, all right, I'll open the gate again and let one more in.
Because, but not the rest of y'all. I can't.
The book is, it's 456 pages. I had to take out over 100 pages just because 10 interviews are actually not even in the book. It refers you to a link.
Is it going
to
be a part two?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I'm actually thinking about doing another book that doesn't have interviews, that is a deeper dive into writing and creating television,
mm-hmm.
only because I did 20 lectures for UCLA, video lectures,
okay. mm-hmm.
and they own the videos, but I own the IP.
Can you download them online?
You will. For students who take online classes, okay. they want to be able to give them a lecture component because
right.
they can't come to campus where I lecture Monday
right.
nights.
Okay,
so I did all these lectures, and each one is stuff I hadn't really talked about before, and mm-hmm. it's all about the changing landscape and how it's affecting storytelling and,
right.
you know, against formula and how people are reinventing, you know, like Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt's kind of reinventing
mm-hmm.
the sitcom. And,
definitely.
So anyway, I think I'll do another book that doesn't have interviews next. Because what happens with a book like this book much more, because this is my fourth book. The other books were basically things I've been teaching that I've experienced myself and that I've experienced through working with students and mm-hmm. with writers. But it was basically just kind of downloading it from my brain and organizing it into these mm-hmm. first three books.
From your perspective.
From my perspective mm-hmm. and my experience. I did want interviews because I hate, in general, screenwriting books where the person writing the book hasn't really accomplished a huge amount.
They worked on Cagney and Lacey and freaking
once. Or
sometimes
nothing, which doesn't mean they can't impart really valuable information.
No, not at all.
But
I
felt like I'm not arrogant, and I wouldn't deign to say I know everything.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
I want to get the people who have done it, you know, mm-hmm. like, and who are doing it. And I welcomed dissension, you know,
mm-hmm.
so I loved it if, you know, different people agreed and disagreed because everybody's right and everybody's wrong. And,
mm-hmm.
and but with this particular book, I knew almost nothing about digital television.
Really?
I took 2 years to research it. I went out with it was very zen, you know, like with a beginner's mind,
mm-hmm.
totally open mind. I didn't have any agenda. And I literally just went around and said, I'm writing this book and I want to find out what you're doing. And like at Netflix talking to Ted Sarandos, who's the head of acquisitions. You know, like, so how did this start? What has it evolved into? What are you looking for? How do you find, you know, how do you develop? Do you not develop? I just started to ask a lot of questions. I went to the Writers Guild and talked to Chuck Slocum, who's the co-executive director, to say, how is this affecting us? Because people are expected to do a lot more work up front. Right. And there's not back-end deals at streaming networks.
I just want to say something really quick. So how I met Neil, Neil came in to, I'm on the education committee at the Writers Guild. And I haven't announced this yet on any of the podcasts. I don't mean to interrupt your time. But,
no problem.
I'm now the vice chair of the Black committee. I haven't even told you. And I'm the vice chair of the LGBT committee. So apparently.
All the intersections.
Okay, look. And, well, that's what I was talking
about. And I'm the new overlord of the universe.
You're very well.
So apparently I'm the first person ever to be on two committees at the same time. On that level, I was like, really? So Jeff called me the other day. He says, so I think we should make you the unofficial of the education committee. I was like, no.
I'm done. In EGOT.
Yes. With the Emmy,
Emmy, Grammy, Oscar, Tony.
Okay, I'll take that.
You'll be like, yes. Of the Writers Guild.
Yes.
Exactly. But he came in and spoke to us, and I was telling you, Neil, you got 2 minutes in, and I was like, wow, we have to have this guy on the show. He's so, you're like an encyclopedia of knowledge. So I find it fascinating that you were saying, you know, 2 years before you wrote the book, you were like, I don't have a clue either, but you're able to master that in 2 years because anything, you just know everything.
Well, anyway, I have, I guess, what I consider to be kind of an ailment, which now I've learned to embrace, which is kind of OCD.
Oh, okay.
So, I remember everything. I mean, I don't have autobiographical memory, you know, right. Like unforgettable, you know, Poppy Montgomery. It's not like that. I can't tell you
Idiot
what
Savant
I was wearing,
or something.
You know, last autumn, you know, on a Thursday. But I remember, it's weird. I don't know. I remember dialogue. I remember plot lines, and I remember the creative auspices of things. I remember names of things. And when people, so everything in the book, it's sort of burned into my brain. I don't know exactly why. And what I did, well, part of it is anytime you do something where it's my words sort of explaining things with a context, both historical and kind of where it's going and putting my spin on it and my opinion, anytime I'm doing that, and I'm writing just from my experience, that's the easiest part of doing these kind of books because I'm summarizing and I'm, you know, it's my voice. When you go to do interviews, it turns into an enormous amount of work because one, I have to prepare for each interview.
Yep.
So that means I have to watch or read every episode because I don't, like my last book, I interviewed like Shonda Rhimes, for example. You don't want to interview Shonda Rhimes without knowing your shit because, you know, she'll dissect you, you know, and she, and it's a sign of respect, you know, that you did your homework. So I spent hundreds, if not thousands of hours just preparing for the interviews. Then I wanted to have smart questions that weren't just the obvious, you know, superficial kind of things. And the interviewees, whenever they realized I was going to try to go deeper into the craft, into the process, they suddenly dropped the guard and they were really like, oh, we're writers. We can talk now.
Yeah. They
so
can
they
relate.
Opened up. Even the most guarded people opened up once they realized, you know, I wanted to kind of get to the creative process and their inspiration and stuff like that. But then once the interviews are done, those are audio recorded. Then they have to be transcribed. Then they have to be edited. Then they have to go back to the interviewee who has to approve it. And then it goes from people like I interviewed Ricky Gervais about Derek on Netflix.
Yeah, that's right.
Ricky Gervais, who was a pleasure and like the nicest guy, like the opposite of his image of being, you know, kind of a jerk. He could not have been more generous and magnanimous and open. He had one word on his interview, which was quite long. He only changed one word. And then there's other people where we went back 4, 5, 6, 7 rounds.
Really? Like you said it. What do you mean you want to change
because
it?
Because sometimes you say stuff and then some time has passed and you look at it and you're like, okay, maybe I need to clarify and make sure, because that's coming off not how I mean. Let me just make sure I just tweak a little bit more, you know?
Anyone who had any kind of, especially executives who had any kind of law school or legal background.
Oh, okay.
And it's what, you know, Hillary gets criticized about a lot, which, you know, I don't understand. I mean, in that you know, she parses language. She's mm-hmm. a lawyer. Mm-hmm. She's very careful about her words. And people say she's not authentic because she's very careful about which word she uses. Mm-hmm. But she's all, I actually respect that as a writer mm-hmm. because words matter. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. I understand the authenticity aspect. But when you're, you know, when you're, when the soundbite in our world now can make or break you and destroy right. you, I think mm-hmm. I appreciate somebody who's very careful about their words. Mm-hmm. So anyway, so it turned out to be, there were 65 interviews, only 55 of them are in the book because the book got so big.
Yeah.
And Tom Fontana, who you mentioned, which I'm glad you mentioned that because when I interviewed...
See how he calls him like as his cousin or something.
No, no. But also like extremely nice. But some of these I got very lucky with because what happened was with a book like this about, you know, digital and streaming and, you know, the game changers, I knew I had to interview Bo Willimon, House of mm-hmm. Cards, Jenji Cohen, Orange is the New Black. I mean, mm-hmm. just because they were such pioneers and they went into a space before it was fashionable.
Exactly. Mm-hmm.
Now everybody is mm-hmm. following in their footsteps. But mm-hmm. at the time, I remember even thinking, why is Jenji Cohen doing Orange is the New Black for Netflix? Like, mm-hmm. it's
every show. Because the first thing yeah. you think of is like, how do they go make money? Yeah. Because your first thought is, because usually when you think of television, the first thing you think of is hand in hand, you think of advertising. Mm-hmm. And yeah. the first thing you think of is like, how are they going to make money if they don't have commercials and stuff? And basically, it says in the book, like, subscribers.
Subscribers. Uh-huh. And I'm it's a renewable resource
yes.
every month. And all they need to do, and we'll get into the philosophy behind yeah, it definitely. In a few minutes, because all they need to do is keep their subscribers happy. And so one of the theses of the book is niche is the new mainstream.
Exactly. Mm.
And
exactly.
you don't need to just create programming that's going to reach the widest, broadest, which often translates to the lowest common mm-hmm. denominator of viewership. Mm-hmm. You can have a very highbrow, smart, sophisticated show like House of Cards. And then you can have Fuller House also on Netflix, which is a, you know, multicam, mm-hmm. you know, not
sitcom,
not the House mm-hmm. of Cards audience. Mm-hmm. And I remember saying to Ted Sarandos in the interview, I said, you know, because I really didn't know. Now it sounds ignorant to have asked him this, but I said, so what's your brand at Netflix? What's your mandate? Are you're looking for sort of smart, you know, layered, nuanced, deep character pieces like Orange is the New Black and House of Cards? And he said, no, absolutely not. In fact, he said, if that was our brand, we would be out of business very
wow,
soon.
Wow, interesting.
We need something for everyone. Mm-hmm. So for them, exclusivity and choice trump reaching the widest possible demographic.
Huh.
You know, and broadcast networks, if you think about the word broadcast, it's mm-hmm. casting the broadest possible net.
Right, sure. Right.
Broadcast networks are now becoming much more niche, however you mm-hmm. want to say mm-hmm. it. And it's causing them to up their game. So shows like American Crime on mm-hmm. ABC, that's a premium cable or streaming mm-hmm. quality show. I think it's a great show. Mm-hmm. And it's an anthology, which used to be a bad word in broadcast television.
I love and
I'm working on getting one of the
anthology
on the show.
David.
It is a great show. And People versus OJ. I mean, FX mm-hmm. and AMC were already kind of going into the premium kind of content sure. route, only with advertising. But so anyway, with Tom Fontana, I was able... Through just, fortunately, I'm old enough and been in the business long enough that I know a lot of people. Mm-hmm. If I call them and say, which I'm in a different place in my career now, so if I call them and say, I want to interview you for my book, or will you come be a guest speaker at UCLA, mm-hmm. I'm very comfortable asking those things. And very rarely will anybody say no, because it's a form of giving back, and they want to be part. This is almost like a historical document. Like, sure. I want to document this revolution when mm-hmm. the whole TV
right.
business changed. If I was calling them and saying, hey, do you have a spot on your writing staff for me?
Mm-hmm.
Will you attach yourself to one of my projects? That would be a very different response. And to tell you the truth, now that I'm 50 something, I love being treated like a peer mm-hmm. and not like, you know, there was a show that, Peter Lefkort did in the 2000s called Beggars and Choosers mm-hmm. on Showtime. Mm-hmm. Remember that show?
Yeah. Yeah.
Which was a good show, which if it was on today would have probably sustained, yeah. you know, mm-hmm. but at the time it was just really difficult to get mm-hmm. anybody to watch a show like that on Showtime because it wasn't what was being developed or even consumed. But Beggars and Choosers, it was about behind the scenes in the TV business, and the executives were the choosers
mm-hmm.
with all the power. You know, the studios and the networks. And the writers, the talent, were the beggars. And you were always, like, trying to bang on the doors.
That's
and
a great little reversal,
waiting for somebody
it?
To give you a break. Yeah. And, I mean, I remember during TV staffing season when I was in my 20s and 30s. Mm-hmm. I mean, that was my... reason for living. You know, I mean, I spent the whole year campaigning and positioning myself and trying to get into mm-hmm. every general meeting and get on all the lists. And if you didn't get staffed, it was like musical chairs. Mm-hmm. You know, when all the chairs were full at the end of staffing season, you were like, well, now what am I going to do?
Mm-hmm.
And you know, you had to really scramble. And now to have this kind of access to showrunners and top executives at companies because of I'm coming at it from a different perspective,
mm-hmm.
I just have to say I like that.
And we feel the same way having the show. We're able to meet those type of people too.
We didn't
know that this was going to open doors for showrunners and people to Glenn Mazera and all these people
just to come and just
show.
Talk and just yeah. say, hey, mm-hmm. you know.
They're very, most people are very generous with their mm-hmm. time and their knowledge and their wisdom and stuff like mm-hmm. that. And what I use it for now is to bring people to UCLA and to help my students.
Sure.
It's not about me and my ego anymore. Mm-hmm. I'm at peace with where I am and mm-hmm. what I'm doing, mm-hmm. fortunately, after many years of not being, you know, beating myself up every morning. But so I got to meet Bo Willimon through a mutual friend who was friends with one of the producers on House of Cards.
Mm-hmm.
And Bo is in New York. So I happened to be going to New York. And so he invited me to lunch. And we had like this really long lunch. And it was weird. It was like he confided in me about all kinds of new projects. Like I knew he was going to be leaving House of Cards, mm-hmm. but he told me, like he really opened up to me off the record once the interview was over. Mm-hmm. Then when he came to LA, we hung out. He then said, are you going to interview Tom Fontana for your book? And I said, well, it's about the digital television revolution. And he said, well, you know, he's done Borgia for Netflix.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But also, he said, if you're going to provide a context for where television is, you have to write about
Tom Fontana.
Because Oz was the first one-hour mm-hmm. drama series for HBO.
Mm-hmm. And not only that, but my show that really made me appreciate police procedurals
homicide.
Because it was fucking homicide.
Oh my God, yes.
Because you know there were shows that'd be like, but because they like totally bent and reshaped what a show about police could be about. Mm-hmm. And that show was my shit.
Yeah, fantastic.
Like, they would have, like, stuff with, like, the best music, and sometimes mm-hmm. they would just have music interludes where the characters would be doing stuff, and it'd be, mm-hmm. like, this music that would, like, tell the story for mm-hmm. you. And it was like, I mean, back in the days.
Because Cold Case started doing that at the end.
Yeah, but it's like people would do all that stuff, and it was like, until you saw that. And then plus, they had like so many rich characters. It was like the first time I saw so many rich male characters. Mm-hmm. The first time I saw a male character question his sexuality,
mm-hmm.
you know, mm-hmm. where mm-hmm. you got to see, you know, and of course one of my favorite characters is one of the few female characters on there. She'd have like her little power suits. And I thought, oh my God, that is so me. I love it. But it changed the game mm-hmm. and it really brought good storytelling. It wasn't about the shoot 'em up and all that. It was really like, it sounds corny now because there's so many shows that are like that now, but I'm telling you, when that shit came out,
mm-hmm.
I would not miss Homicide for the world. Like yeah. I would like have my little VHS tape in there. Like I was not gonna miss this.
All the kids listening, you know? Are like, what's a VHS?
No, I know.
Yeah,
I know.
Exactly. It feels
then,
like that.
And then
ago.
From time to move from that to doing stuff from, you know, from HBO, where at HBO, as children back in the old days, home box office. You when you went to a movie, you wouldn't see it again. This is almost before we had, you know, video stores.
Mm-hmm.
When HBO came out, it was like bonkers because now we could see movies and you pay your little, and it was like weird, like people are gonna pay money, you know, every month on top of like regular free TV.
Mm-hmm.
And it, you know, and so you'd have movies and stuff like that. But then when they started making scripted, people were like, how the fuck are you gonna make money?
Mm-hmm.
You know, this is a business. Mm-hmm. How are you gonna make money?
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Well, with Netflix in particular, Netflix is now in every country in the world except for China.
So oh, really?
Even in
I didn't
Russia
know that.
Now. I mean, you know, the hotbed of piracy. But mm-hmm. they do have subscribers in every country. And I think once you watch TV without commercials, it's hard to go back.
Oh my God.
You know?
Oh my
and
God.
People
it
do
is.
Like free stuff, mm-hmm. but people also value their time. Mm-hmm. So if you can watch, you know, like I don't know if you've seen Casual on Hulu.
Yeah. I think
really
I've seen
great
an episode
show.
Too.
Jason Reitman's involved mm-hmm. in it, and a guy named Xander Lehman created it,
mm-hmm.
who, by the way, you know, like had. It's his first show he created. He's now running the show.
Okay.
He's an executive producer.
That's not bad.
I love
you know,
that.
He wrote it on spec, and Hulu just loved his voice, and they gave him a shot, which, all you know, those kinds of things didn't mm-hmm. happen. It was very rare. I mean, Sam Esmail, who does Mr. Robot. Mm-hmm. He'd never created a show, and he's running a show and directing mm-hmm. and writing almost all the episodes for the new season. That's mm-hmm. It's very unusual. Right. But on Casual, you have the option on Hulu that you can either watch it with commercials or without. If you pay slightly more, like an extra $2 a month, you can watch without commercials. And so without commercials, you can watch an episode of Casual in about 21, 22 minutes. And
you can't help but binge it, right?
Yeah.
And
you
God.
Can watch, or like Catastrophe, Transparent, mm-hmm. all the shorter orders and the shorter mm-hmm. lengths of the episodes. Mm-hmm. You can watch the whole season very, very quickly. Sure. But Casual, I just find that it cuts to black where the commercial would be, but when you're watching it without the commercials, there's just a rhythm to it.
Yes.
That is so important. And mm-hmm. so I think people do value that. There are streaming services now. There's one called CISO, which is I write about in the book. It's NBC Universal streaming all comedy 24/7 network. Huh. Okay. And it was basically designed to not – it's a subscription service, but it's considered an add-on. So it's about $3 or $4 a month.
Mm-hmm. And that's not bad.
And if you get an Amazon Prime membership mm-hmm. to watch Amazon Studios content, you can now get, they'll add on CISO for you. And
oh, that's good to know.
No commercials. It's like all seasons of Saturday Night Live and all the NBC, like The Office and Parks and Rec and all of those shows. Mm-hmm. And then they're Monty Python stuff that's kind of digitized.
Oh, my God.
So they have all the legacy stuff. But then, I'm friends with Evan Shapiro, who's the guy who basically launched CISO. It was his project. He used to be president of Pivot, which is a digital cable network. Mm-hmm. But so I saw him recently, and I said, how's it doing? Because it just launched pretty recently, and it's like surpassed all of their expectations.
Really?
And I said, what's doing best? Is it people downloading old episodes of SNL?
Mm-hmm.
And he said, no, our originals by far are the most popular.
Because people are tired of seeing same shit. Yep.
You've been saying it
like
for
this
how
is.
Long?
Oh, look, this is my thing.
Yeah.
And like now, I'm gonna have to go write Netflix and say, can I just come watch movies and help y'all curate? Because here's my problem now, and this is a network. No, this is a network I wish I could create. Maybe I should just create it myself mm-hmm. because there's so many international shows. Like there's this one show I want to see that's from Iceland. And oh God, I can't remember the same, but it's on the same, it has a similar feel for a show I just watched, and I'm hoping they got to, just got a second season called Fortitude.
Yes.
But it's another one that takes place in Iceland where it's like this murder mystery and they're stuck because a blizzard has come in, like mm-hmm. this cruise ship has come in, there's a murder mystery. God, I can't keep myself.
That sounds like my kind of show.
But it's from Iceland.
Okay.
And I've been going on, I'm not saying I'm doing illegal stuff, but what I'm saying is I'm going online and I'm trying to find it. And I just found out the Weinsteins had just, they got the rights to it to broadcast it soon. But the problem with that is they're taking too damn long. So I wish I could make, either my own mm-hmm. kind of Netflix thing, or if mm-hmm. Netflix lets me do it for them and they just pay me, where the top international TV shows, where I could watch them and pay whatever it is and not have to wait for another country to buy the rights to it and either A, try to make a remake and take forever, fucking long. Yeah. I want to see the original thing in the people's language subtitle. Like there's shows in Brazil I fucking want to see.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And there's shows that are in the, I just found a show on Amazon from the Ukraine. It has a terrible title, but I like the show called The Sniffer. It's kind of like, it's a Ukraine show and they had it came out in 2013. They had one episode, fuck them, why? But terrible title. Mm-hmm. But a guy is the mentalist, but he could smell stuff and figure out crimes and stuff. So it's all these amazing international TV shows that I want to watch because mm-hmm. I'm tired of looking at regular American content.
Yeah,
I want to see the world. And thank God Amazon and Netflix are starting to do that where, they said things that you can see and they've got them broken down by mm-hmm, countries. Mm-hmm. The thing is, I need them to up their whoever's picking the films, because some of the shit they're picking for their foreign stuff is mm-hmm. Y'all, okay.
I tend to watch all the British shows on Netflix.
I think I've watched everything from Britain so far.
So well done.
Yeah, me too.
Now I've moved into the Ukraine and Iceland. I want to see everything. Yeah, yeah. I don't want to see regular American white folk. I'm tired of that. I want to see what other white folk in other parts of the world are doing. What y'all doing? Because they look like real interesting people. It's here we get our regular Hollywood look. So it's I've got to figure out a way. And for me, that's specific niche.
Let me ask you a question.
TV,
Let me ask you
specific.
You probably get this question a lot based on your book. Why is it that Netflix and the other big Hulus and whatever can get away with not telling you how many viewers they have?
Well, it's just starting to shift where they are now starting to report. And okay. there is a way they can measure viewership. The main reason is just that they're not beholden to advertisers, which
they ain't telling
them. They don't need to because that's all about determining ad rates.
And that might fuck up my shows that I particularly want to watch.
Because Marco Polo is back and I'm like,
oh my God, yeah, it might be something specific and small. Like, for example, Fortitude. Like, a lot of people are probably not interested in a murder mystery horror thing set in Icelandic places, you know, with no famous people in it, so to speak, you know.
Yep.
And it's like, oh, if they saw those numbers, oh, well, only Lisa and that guy down in Australia are watching it. Mm-hmm. The show ain't making us. I pay my subscription.
Yeah, yeah.
I want to see that show. Y'all can watch Adam Sandler if you want to. But don't. It's like almost I'm afraid for them not to because then I don't know. Maybe it's the stigma of people thinking
stigmatizes
of only a small amount of people are watching it. But look, we all know McDonald's ain't the best hamburger. On the planet.
Right. Quantity doesn't necessarily
correspond. Do they have to do it now or did they decide to do it now? What happened?
Well, they're just people who are, a lot of the agents and people who represent the talent like to use numbers like that to also justify,
it helps them.
You know,
I see.
Making deals and quotes and how much, and then just budgets for the show. I think so a lot of people want to know the numbers. A lot of people don't.
Mm-hmm.
You know, one of the people I interviewed in the book who, you can read the interview, like if you go to the hyperlink or the web bonus, you know, website content.
Bonus content.
But it's this guy, his name is Byron Blasco, and he did a show, he does a show called Kingdom for DirecTV.
Mm-hmm.
It's a, you know, people know it because Nick Jonas is in it, right? It's about cage fighters. It's a really good show. Like, it's so not a show that I would have normally watched, but MMA, cage fighters.
That's
people
my
love
thing.
That, yeah.
Great writing, really good acting, and it's now going into, I think they're going on the fourth season now.
Oh,
terms
I
of
thought
the
it
script.
Was third season. Wow,
third season's
good.
Airing, but I think they're now going into a fourth season.
Yeah. Okay.
And I said to him, you know, do you have any idea what your ratings are? It's DirecTV. It's not even a digital streaming thing. It's. He said, I have no idea. It doesn't matter to me. He goes, I get to make the show I want to make.
Right.
Yes.
They don't micromanage or interfere very much.
Really?
And he worked on a lot of, you know, broadcast network shows where you're just always anxious.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you're on a hit show, you're anxious. That
those overnights, like the stress. I remember when our friends that work in TV, like in the early days, you know, like I would say up to like maybe 15 years ago, if a new show was coming out, you know, it's premiering and then those overnight numbers start coming in and they don't hit a certain number, then they're like, well, we're going to cancel this show.
Dead.
You know, there ain't enough people watching. Yeah. And, of course, my argument was, you don't let them give enough time
they
to build
even,
an
they haven't
audience.
Even figured out what the show is
that's
for the first four episodes. You know?
Part of why this is literally a revolution is, you know, overnight, Nielsen ratings are completely irrelevant now.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody cares about them anymore.
Mm-hmm. And also, let's be real. When you talked about Nielsen in the old days, not everybody had a Nielsen box in their house.
True.
A lot of folks that were determining what shows were staying or whatever weren't necessarily people from marginalized groups that
That's
had
true.
To kind of say that, you know. So a lot of times, Nielsen's were skewered towards a certain audience, Mid-America, Midwest, you know, the broadest of the broad, you know.
Yep.
And it's like, so a lot of times there'd be shows that, you know, where I know everybody, my friends were watching, and they're like, oh, we're going to cancel. It's not getting the rating. I'm like, not getting the ratings. You know, talk to every black person I know and every Latino. Everybody's watching that show.
Mm-hmm.
You know, white folks ain't watching it. So what? So that's not for them. Maybe this is something, you know.
Yeah,
and so you get into those kind of, you know, numbers where certain audience are dictating and preventing other people from seeing stuff because, well, these folks over here don't like it and these numbers are showing. But if you would have had that box in everybody else's house, you would have seen that it's totally different.
Let me ask you a quick question, just piggybacking off of that. Now, what you've learned from the people you interviewed in this book, now you hear that rumor that, oh, you know, diversity doesn't particularly sell across the seas. Have you found the same? Is it still the same for this digital world where you live in England, for instance, or, you know, Iceland or whatever the fuck?
Right.
And you get Netflix.
Right now, like, what does that
and you get Netflix, you know what I mean? And you have the opportunity now to choose as opposed to only getting what they give you, you know?
Right.
Are we seeing the ratings change because of that or just out of curiosity?
One of the greatest honors, or you know, that I had with all the interviews, is I got to interview Norman Lear. And
oh my God. You see how you spit his name out like he done, you see what I'm talking about?
Do you know how old Norman is now? I just heard an interview with him. He's 93. Well, yeah. No, he's 94 now. Yeah, because yeah, I just heard him on NPR.
I just heard it too.
And he was doing a quiz
show.
He was
so funny.
Oh my God. And I still have the letter that he signed when he rejected me years ago from trying to write when I was like 13. Where he says, "We don't take unsolicited stuff." And I have it framed. And I'm like, "Thank you, sir."
Well, because what was interesting is that in the 70s, when Norman Lear had his shows, which mm-hmm. had lots of people of color, I mean, you had Good Times about an African American yeah. mm-hmm. family and the projects that mm-hmm. nobody had ever done those kinds of
that
things.
That should have been called Struggling. Yeah,
exactly. That's so good. It was ironic, though.
It was no ironic. Good Times. Hanging in a chat line. Struggling.
But we had diversity. We had full diversity on TV. Mm-hmm. They were most of those Norman Lear shows. Whether he was directly, you know, running the show or he brought mm-hmm. people in, those were in the top 10 of the Nielsens, mm-hmm. and they were, you know, they were successful, and right. people watched them, and mm-hmm. they were mainstream. And then something happened. What I call probably like the Aaron Spelling years, and mm-hmm. maybe it was Reagan, mm-hmm. but the 80s, 90s, mm-hmm. going into the early 2000s. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was this white space.
Those soaps at night.
And a lot of times it was starting to get into corporate and more relying on more like who we're going to appeal to, mm-hmm. who's our audience, and the Reaganomics and the whole trickle down and trickling everybody else out.
Someone trickling it, right?
And then there was, well, and this is something that has not changed in 2016, which is the executive suites at the big yeah. networks are still over 95% all white.
Yeah.
And it's male and female, but mm-hmm. I mean, so the gatekeepers are still not representing diversity.
Gatekeepers, get you some black friends, more than one, so that we could just be there and like, look, you're losing out on so much money.
Yeah,
You know what happened during those intervening years after the Norman Lear, you know, yeah. years, which were those great shows and people watched them and they were extremely mm-hmm. popular. I guess somehow they just decided the desired demographic for what they were selling were not, you know, who they considered to be minorities, or mm-hmm. the marginalized weren't the people who they thought
or even the advertising, the products that, well, black people aren't buying this stuff. Let's mm-hmm. get stuff. And it's like, we buy every damn thing.
Yeah.
And it's, but they just, they're that myopic view of what the mainstream viewer, mm-hmm. and I'm doing air quotes, people, you can't see this.
on the air.
Yeah. You know, mainstream viewers and those markets, it was just like, when I go back, now that you can go back and watch these old TV shows, mm-hmm. I forget how many people of color, how yeah. many were on there. And it's when you get to those 80s and later shows, you're like, yeah, the friends 70s,
like
and
you said,
everything.
It was very diverse.
It was like, what happened?
Mm-hmm. It's, well, and even Jenji Kohan, you know, when she, well, I have to backtrack to that for a minute, sure. just because it relates to the diversity topic, which, and I also wrote about Russell Simmons was talking, because NATP, which is the mm-hmm. National Association of Television Programming Executives, this is the first book that they sponsored. So they're, it's, you know, their little logos on the cover.
I saw that. I was
which
like,
was really, what? Well, it was a great opportunity just because I got to go to NATP for the book launch.
That's a stamp right there.
That also yeah. really helped me get to people. And Russell Simmons, when he was talking, he was even saying, you know, like, Key and Peele, he says, Key and Peele, when it was on, was comedy for white folks.
You know what?
He did say that.
You know what?
I heard him talk
okay,
about
and
that.
I will disagree because I watched that show. As soon as those episodes were available to buy, I bought them. Mm-hmm. I would tweet to them like, who was doing your hair? They would tweet back like, it's our special person who did this. Like, mm-hmm. I love that show. And I know there were black people who were watching it too.
I love that.
So,
I don't know what
but if you look at the ratings, which they did, because Comedy Central does report, mm-hmm. it's like a 70-80% white audience for Key and Peele. I'm not saying
understood.
That black people don't appreciate it, yeah. but he was just making the point that it was safe and accessible.
What?
Safe.
I
thought they crossed a line.
Not controversial. I'm talking about, he was saying it was stuff that white people could watch and laugh at and feel part of the joke
okay.
as opposed to.
I see where
he was making points about content where black content creators, people would say, we can't understand you. We need to subtitle that.
Mm-hmm.
We need you to be more white. Mm-hmm. We meet, or like Margaret Cho, I write about in that chapter too, you know, when she did her show, All American right. Girl,
mm-hmm.
they said she was too Asian and then not Asian enough. And she was, you know, like they were trying to change her from what she was mm-hmm. to fit into something. And I think he was just saying...
It was whitewashing. Let's just be real. Call it what it is. Whitewashing out. Hashtag. Shout out to the fam out there. You know, it's... You know, I don't know. Sometimes they ask people, like when they talk about Russell Simmons and stuff, who's had some questionable content on his shit. I'm just saying. But sometimes you ask people, it's like, oh, it's because of this. Like, y'all got to talk to some more folk.
No, I agree with that. Definitely. But
I understand what you're saying.
But the Jenji Cohen point in relation to that is when she went to do Orange is the New Black, she famously has said, I mean, it's based on a memoir by a blonde, you know, white woman who went to prison, but she said she needed Piper. She needed
that white Trojan horse.
She called it the Trojan horse.
Yeah, it is. It's the white Trojan horse to make white people comfortable. Yep. Like, oh my God, there are so many people of color that I can't relate to. Oh, but here's a nice, safe white woman who's going to hold my hand and make me feel like I can relate. And then, oh my God, you people are just like everybody else. Mm-hmm. I totally get that, but it's tiresome.
It is tiresome, and interestingly enough, I did say to her, you know, do you think if you were trying to sell Orange is the New Black now that Netflix has taken off and that people are, you know, we have Blackish and Fresh Off the Boat and American Crime, and do you think you would still need that if you were going to sell it now, like in 2017?
What she said?
She said she thinks she probably still
would. She would. Yeah,
listen to this.
She would.
This was one of the most interesting takeaways from all the interviews. So I said, after the, you know, you created Weeds, which was a very successful show. It was on, I think, for 5 or 6 seasons. I said, so after the success of Weeds, why did you decide to do Orange is the New Black for Netflix and not for Showtime?
Yeah. Could have went right in
you
there.
You know the answer? Showtime passed.
Really?
They said, show in a woman's prison, not our audience. You know, Showtime has a pretty conservative, their audience, I think they're... The average age of their viewers is like 60.
Really?
If you think of The Affair.
They can handle Shameless? Homeland,
60 with a penis.
Okay. Now, here's even more interesting. So I said to her, okay, so you know, Showtime passed, even though Weeds was super successful and you were a brand unto yourself. Then you do Orange is the New Black for Netflix. Now she has another show that's coming called The Devil You Know about Salem witches with sort of her spin on it, which is going to be on HBO.
HBO.
HBO. I don't know if y'all read that article. What's his name? Anyway, I find the article. I saved it. He has said some interesting things, and he's got me excited for some of the stuff that they're trying to do that's coming out now, too. But it's like, I think they're waking up. They're realizing we passed on some really good shit.
See, I keep thinking, I mean, to keep your thought, I keep thinking Glenn should have, I know he was already at that network developing The Omen, whatever the show he was doing, Damien. And I keep thinking... That should have went to HBO or something. It should have been more.
But people don't realize the behind-the-scenes machinations, because I said to Jenji Cohen, why are you doing The Devil You Know for HBO and not for Netflix?
Right.
Because Orange is the New Black is a bona fide phenomenon. I mean, in this new season, the ratings are just, they did track them, and they're very high.
They win the Emmys, and they're killing
them. Reason she's doing The Night Of for HBO and not Netflix is that Netflix passed on, Devil You Know. They passed because it just wasn't for them.
So let's get into this, which is, I think, the real important part of your book and your research is break down for us the brands, what it is that each one, because I think a lot of times we're trying to get our content out there. Let's break it down. What's Netflix thing? What is their brand?
Netflix is exclusivity and choice.
Okay.
So... Because all they need to do, and this is an important distinction, because Netflix and Amazon are by far the largest, you know, streaming on-demand services.
Sure. I have both of them.
There's a very big difference between them. Netflix is a media company. Amazon is a retail company.
And they got more money, too.
Amazon is the world's largest retailer now. It's eclipsed Walmart. So what Amazon needs to do is kind of like the shopping mall, which I fear is probably an endangered species, public libraries.
I don't even go to malls. I go to Melrose.
Well, but think about the shopping mall. The idea of it was there was a big megaplex.
Right.
You'd go there either to see a movie and you'd buy something at a shop before the movie, or you'd eat, or you'd go shopping and then decide to see a movie. So they were magnets to draw you.
It was a teenage heaven.
You'd ride my bike. Movies were cheap.
Right.
Beauty school drop.
Now, that's what Amazon is. They're going to get you to the site to either watch one of their shows, or, but no matter, the bottom line for them is they want you to shop. and they want you to, and I believe in a not very, it's already starting, but it's going to become more prevalent. When you're watching not only Amazon shows, but other shows, you'll be able to interact with the show. So if somebody's wearing a jacket, you think it's
cool. Child, you can click onto the jacket. Mm-hmm. It'll show up. The movie, the show you're watching will freeze. It'll take you to the screen where it's like, this is how much it is. What color do you want it in? What size?
It'll comparison shop. Your comparison credit card shop. Will be stored.
Wow. It will send it to you, and you will press submit and send, and then you will go back and watch the show and continue on. Oh, my God.
Yes.
Wow. This is straight out the Jetson.
We in trouble. Yeah.
Well, you know, Alfie in trouble.
You in danger, girl.
You in danger, girl.
You were talking about some of the directors who passed away, but Alvin Toffler, you know, Future Shock.
Future Shock.
Mm-hmm. He prophesized a lot of these things. Mm-hmm. So Amazon basically just wants you to go to their site and shop. And if it's watching one of their shows or any, you know, any content you want to download or stream, that's their goal.
Right.
Netflix is a media company, so they just need you to be happy so you don't cancel your subscription, which means that every time
I'm sorry, but this is important. Why do they only have certain movies? Why do they only have certain movies that are streaming, and the other ones you have to get the DVD? And they're new movies.
It's all kinds of licensing deals, and you know, part of the problem is that Netflix, in some ways, the other media companies and the networks felt a bit almost ambushed.
Okay.
Because, which I don't think was malicious on Netflix's part. I just don't think they had any idea how huge this was all going to be. So, for example, Breaking Bad. Mm-hmm. When it was on AMC, it was not a hit. It was a very modest ratings, you know, show.
It was like The Wire. It was like, that's the selective niche, you know, us who knew it, you know.
And David Simon, by the way, shout out to David Simon, who worked on Homicide with Barry Levinson and Tom Fontana. So, and David Simon was way ahead of his time with doing that slow burn, serialized storytelling and having that, you know, theme for the whole season and diversity and so many things. Mm-hmm. But anyway, so Netflix, when you go to your Netflix screen, you're going to see what's new. And most people now, especially kids and people who are really adept at, you know, technologically savvy and media savvy, they're going to immediately go, seen it, what's new, what's new. So it used to be, you know, like Breaking Bad. Breaking Bad became a huge hit on Netflix, and a lot of people thought that it was a Netflix original and that they discovered it on Netflix.
Because they give that title to a lot of stuff, you know, Netflix original.
Yeah, yeah,
which
true.
Is, in a lot of cases, it's not a Netflix original.
It's not,
What it means is it's more of a Netflix exclusive, like it's now the only place you can watch it, but there's fewer chances for that now because there are lots of places you can watch or buy and all of those kinds of things. So they just have to make sure that you're happy and have enough choice that you're going to go, this warrants my monthly subscription fee. But now the networks, you know, CBS has CBS All Access and all the networks, you know, ABC, NBC, Fox, they all have on-demand streaming. CBS is going to relaunch, you know, Star Trek as a series, but it's going to premiere on CBS All Access.
Right.
So it used to be they'd figure, well, we might as well monetize our second window and, you know, Netflix will pay us money for a show. We're just going to, you know, thank you very much, Netflix. We'll take your money.
Right.
But what happened is Netflix was the place everybody started to go as the destination just to watch everything.
Right.
So now you're seeing people leaving Netflix where you can't watch things that you used to. And, and you get notices.
Yeah, they let us know. They had a whole list. Like, they're taking all the Star Trek shit. They're taking away 2001 Odyssey, Space Odyssey.
You can't watch The Wire Netflix anymore.
And they've taken out. And now I got to jump over to Amazon because I can watch The Wire and everything else over there. So,
or HBO Now or HBO Go. So they're now, people are getting wise and not viewing Netflix as another revenue stream. They're looking at them as a behemoth competitor.
Right.
And they don't want to help them. So one of the biggest game changers of the last few days was how Starz was bought by Lionsgate.
Yeah.
Lionsgate movies are not doing well,
right?
They haven't been, but their TV, they're killing it, right? So now they're going to be able to make content and distribute it themselves on their own, on Starz. They paid, you know, over $5 billion for that. So they don't, because, you know, Lionsgate makes Orange is the New Black. They're the ones who are making the money much more than Netflix, because Netflix in the early days did not own their content. Now you're going to see Netflix productions. They're going to cut out.
They're going to start doing their own production, in-house productions.
Yes. And places like Lionsgate, if they don't have ways to distribute themselves, they're going to always have to go make deals with distribution companies. And they, I think they're going to start to make a lot more money if they can make this work.
And
so,
what about Hulu?
Well, Hulu's not international, so it's almost only domestic.
Oh, I didn't know that.
It's a few territories, like, you know, I think the Bahamas and Puerto Rico and some of the, you know, things. But it's not international yet.
Yes.
Hulu originally began, and this is also another lesson that I learned, which is they began pretty much as a second window. So it was, their business model was where the place to go to watch reruns. If you missed Jane the Virgin, come to Hulu. What's happened to all of those companies that were primarily monetizing through second window content, which is a fancy word for reruns.
Right. I love how we change it. Like, we can't call it that. I can't call it a used car. A pre-owned vehicle.
It's not a hoopty.
It's not a hoopty.
Okay. It's just pre-owned. It's pre-owned.
So it's not a second window anymore. But now, unless you're, if you're Hulu and you're not making original content, you're toast. You can never stay in business. Just because there's too many other places to watch stuff that you missed. So that's why you're seeing, you know, they did 11/22/63 and they have Casual, and you're going to start to see Difficult People, more and more originals on Hulu. They're on the map now. People have discovered them. They have, you know, good shows. So I think that's where we're going, basically. Mm-hmm. And the broadcast networks are not going to go away mainly because of sports.
Right.
You know, people want to watch sports live. Right. As soon as there's a way to stream sports live reliably, like the Super Bowl, people could stream it, but more people watched it traditionally.
Sure.
Although, ironically, people like to watch
it. It's like the only time all the gay people come together.
Well, the thing is, because
we don't watch it, too.
Well, people like the commercial Super Bowl because it's an exclusive new commercial that you're not going to see yet. So it's almost fun watching the commercials just to see what controversial and interesting.
I want to see who my friends are. Like, who's in there.
Like, that whole thing with the whole, you know, Super Bowl thing, like, changed the game. Usually, you're trying to avoid the commercials. Now, it's like, I can't. They're, like, doing commercials for the new commercials. Mm-hmm. They're coming, like, don't forget to watch the Super Bowl. We're having a new thing. That's, so is Crackle like that with Hulu? I mean,
Crackle is advertising. So it's AVOD, advertising, advertiser supported video on demand.
Okay.
So it's more like, you know, it's on demand, meaning you don't have to watch. I think linear television will go away other than sports. I think time slots are going to go away because, you know, nobody under the age of 40 watches commercials or shows in their time slots anymore. It's rare. It's rare. My mother's going to be 80.
They don't even have TVs in their room.
Do you know how upset
kids
my mother
don't even
is?
Have TVs. They just look at their
TV.
Phones.
None
and
of them.
It's crazy.
I have my computer, and if I really want to have the movie experience, I put my LCD projector all across the wall.
But
and
that's
I have it.
Now.
You know, my mother's upset, though.
Oh,
oh, my God. Yeah. She's so like, well, when does it come? What channel is this on? Now, it's advertising on this channel. It's like, Mama, just let me just, what do you want to see? And I will help you find it. Last two things.
Yeah.
HBO and Showtime.
Well, both, they're very similar to Netflix now in that they have their on-demand options. They have movies that you can watch. They make a lot of originals that are, you know, very high quality. They're all over the world. There's the biggest difference, I would say, is that HBO and Showtime still do a lot of development. And but Netflix is going to spend over, I think it's over $5 billion on production and development.
Goodness.
So they're outspending everybody now because, you know, but HBO still likes to do a lot of development. And I know people with HBO deals. And it's one of the reasons, you know, Jill Soloway did Transparent for Amazon because she didn't want to sit in development hell and spend, you know, put her heart and soul and blood into something and then not have it get on the air. She knew it was going to get a full series order. It was a commitment. And HBO won't do that necessarily. You know, Amazon greenlit Woody Allen's new series because he's Woody Allen.
Sure.
But so Netflix is not that much into development. So when I say they're spending a lot of money, it's on production and it's on acquisitions of, you know, formats and content, comic books, you know, Marvel's Jessica Jones and things like that.
Right.
Netflix, generally, what Ted Sarandos said is they're not in, they're not going to buy something that's half-baked. They're in the fully baked business, so, which is not a euphemism for recreational marijuana. They are, so they want a package. They want a pilot script. They want at least one other episode. They want a full series Bible, and they want a hot director, and they want a showrunner. They want cast. You know, they, everybody says they took a big gamble on House of Cards because they greenlit two seasons for over $200 million. Full commitment. But they had David Fincher, they had Kevin Spacey, they had Robin Wright, they had Bo Willimon. And last thing, because I know I'm going to run out of time, ratings are not the metric for success like they used to be. But algorithms are how everything is. Not everything, because there's still the gut.
Sure.
And but you know, they knew based on algorithms that House of Cards had a very it was a safe bet in that political thrillers are very popular on Netflix. Mm-hmm. Fincher's popular. Spacey movies are popular. So they ran the numbers, and it looked like it was a pretty sure bet. Mm-hmm. Vimeo, which you were asking me about before.
Like
Vimeo,
is it going to become the new? I mean, Vimeo is pretty much you upload your stuff, people can go and watch it.
Vimeo is a very
most young filmmakers use it
more than YouTube.
Now, you know what I mean? Because it's clean. It's just
and
by
YouTube
itself.
Red is now developing content,
sure.
But Vimeo generally is a curated YouTube because on YouTube everything is equal. So cat videos are considered classified the same way as something with more, you know, higher production values.
Right.
Vimeo tends to be, you know, more professionally produced content. But the thing that Vimeo has that's two really huge aspects of it that are valuable to content creators. Mm-hmm. One is they only take 10% of content. So if you're putting your show on Vimeo and you're monetizing it, you're going to keep 90%, which is very unusual.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, that's one thing. The other is, though, it's a place for what is sort of the name of the game now for people who are trying to break in, which is proof of concept.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So if you can go on Vimeo and get a lot of traffic, if you are lucky enough to become a staff pick on Vimeo, which is not based on algorithms and is a sacrosanct process, like just internally the staff decide which, if you become a staff pick on Vimeo, you're going to get hundreds of thousands of views, if not up to 1 million. And,
you know,
that applies to like a show like High Maintenance, which is now going to be on HBO because of their success on Vimeo, you know, so, or Issa Rae, you know, with Awkward Black Girl.
Yeah.
Her number's built.
Insecure now.
Yeah,
Insecure. She's on HBO, but it built and
took damn long. Everybody else got their show in like
they
in
were
2 seconds.
Like you said, the development
took too long.
Time.
You took too long. You already knew what she was going to bring to the table.
Yeah.
And y'all took all that time. Yeah. Y'all tried to break a sister. But Issa, you hung tough, girl. And we're looking forward to it.
We're going
to
have her on the show.
She's great. I interviewed her also for the book.
She's badass.
And she's, the thing is that, in her case, who knows? I mean, it might have been that they were just frightened that they were creating, you know.
They brought an awkward black girl in. Too much.
Don't worry about that. But at the same time, she is a purist, you know. She was not kowtowing and going, I'll do whatever you want. She's like, this is who I am. This is what my show is.
Yep,
and
right.
So I think she fought a lot of those battles to make the show she is proud of. And I'm excited to see it.
Yeah.
I haven't seen any of it yet. But, you know, she self-financed the first season of Awkward Black Girl.
Yeah.
And she created the big buzzword across all these platforms when you're saying, what are they looking for?
Right.
Authenticity.
That and that authenticity, you know, it's niche. I'm sorry. I mean, it's the specific is universal. And I know for a fact, the shows that I watch now, they have a certain specific thing that I want to see. And I'm glad I live in a time now where I can choose what I want to see when I want to see it. Like if I want to spend the whole weekend as a burrito sipping my liquor and my snacks with my dog. Damn it, that's how I was last weekend.
I believe you.
And as soon as I leave here, I'm going to return because they know on Netflix, shout out to Netflix, y'all put Marcella, that English show I've been waiting to see because I'm in love with Nicholas Pinot from Top Boy.
Uh-huh.
Oh my God. Oh my God. I love that actor.
Top Boy.
Oh my God. I love that actor. And then it's like, soon that show came up and I'm watching the show and it's like, yes, and another true crime, almost crazy British show. She's like the female Luther, like, I would not be able to do that on regular television.
No, I would be
waiting for years. That show has probably been pitched and turned down and development hell. Mm-hmm. And now it's like I have access. I don't have to wait for the network. Mm-hmm. Speaking of network, Weinstein Brothers, the show I was telling y'all about, it's called Trapped.
Trapped.
I haven't seen it.
Okay, look it up. You can see it's already aired. Hopefully BBC America is supposed to be airing it pretty soon. It's taking too long.
Where did you find it before? Did you use online?
You know what? I'm a cinephile, bitch. I thought you heard.
I forgot.
You need to know who you're dealing with over here. You need to understand who you're fucking with over here.
The world.
Online doing some shit she wasn't supposed to be doing.
And you know, you get in the circles, and somebody said, "Hey,
that's a lot of it."
And I was on the black net, the dark net, And somebody said, since you like this show, you really need to check out. Got it. But it's already aired. Like, I've been trying to go. I've been on places in Norway. Your computer can hold this. I'm like, damn it, man. Mm-hmm. But basically, you can go on YouTube and look at the trailer.
Okay.
And it's fantastic. Mm-hmm. My problem is, I need to create my own network, mm-hmm. and my network is just basically going to be basically like top shows mm-hmm. in other countries that you can see that are international.
That's interesting.
International shows that are specifically like true crime, mm-hmm. psychological thrillers, horror. Because a lot of the horror, I just need to curate some shit.
You do.
Because it's like, because some of the stuff I'd be seeing is like, Amazon, why is this show on Netflix? Why is this show on here? Come on, I can show you some better shit.
Because they just want you to have lots of choices. So
I appreciate that. But we need to open up and get some more shit that's a little bit different.
Well, and last thing I want to say, even though I probably said that
and then,
three times.
And then go into the book where they can get it and where you...
The thing about authenticity, which is across all the platforms, is the number one, what everybody mm-hmm. wants. Mm-hmm. The reason this is a revolution is that you cannot manufacture authenticity.
Oh, you can't.
And so no matter how much money you have, mm-hmm. you can't manufacture it. So the voices that are coming through are purely authentic. They sure. can make content themselves, distribute it themselves. It's unfiltered. Advertisers are even discovering that authentic voices versus celebrities are better at selling their products. Mm-hmm. Hair products, beauty products, if it's coming from an authentic person who's like, I've always struggled with my hair and I finally found this product that makes me feel, you know, halfway beautiful. Mm-hmm. That has a lot more value than, say, you know, Jennifer Aniston selling a hair product. Mm-hmm. Because people are going to go, well, of course her hair looks great.
Look,
she's rich. She can do whatever she wants.
Okay. Advertisers, let me let you in a little secret. Nowadays, people don't want to buy. If you have a celebrity hawking your product, nobody wants to buy that product. Because we are hip to the idea that these people have stylists and people who dress them, who beat their faces for them, who lay their hair down. We know that stuff. So if you really want to get me, you got to get the regular Joe on the schmo. Like, bitch, this is what my hair looked like before. In my own bed. Like, I go to YouTube. Like, look, I swear to God. When I'm looking for a new hair product, I go to YouTube and I watch them heifers that are in their own kitchen. Like, look, this is what my hair, and they doing their hair right there. I'm not looking at Jennifer.
I put some butter.
Okay.
And some honey.
All right. And then they
come
back.
Water,
and some
water,
bitch. And they freeze the camera and they come back. All right, y'all, this is what it look like. Exactly. And I'm like, I believe in that. And you know how many products I've bought? Because I've been watching other people, just regular people sell stuff as opposed to like Jennifer Aniston or, you know,
but this
all
is
those
revolutionary
people.
Because mm-hmm. it is. Advertising was not based upon that at all before. That's a huge change just because mm-hmm. of social media and people having access to things. And the other thing about authenticity is not only do people trust it and believe mm-hmm. in it, when the corporations do try to manufacture authenticity, if viewers, especially teenagers, get a whiff and it seems like they're pandering or trying mm-hmm. to sort of manufacture the marketing to them,
the bullshit
they seem authentic, they turn against it.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. And they'll actually diss it and they'll trash it and they'll bring it down. Mm-hmm. So, you know, this
clapback
really
is real.
This is really the people's revolution. Exactly. Right. So the book is called TV Outside the Box, Trailblazing in the Digital Television Revolution. And you can, the easiest place to get it is on Amazon, mm-hmm. but you can also get it if you go to like focalpress.com or taylorandfrancis.com, which is the publisher. Mm-hmm. And what else can I tell you?
Oh, my God. You've got everything. Webisodes, the next iteration of adult animation, Beyond MTV, Food is Art, digital magazines. You've got Breaking Down Barriers, Life After Broadcast, The Impact of Digital Television on Cinema.
It's current.
But
that's what
look.
It's all
this
there.
Book,
are
like,
you on Twitter?
This book just came out this year, right? It just
What's
came
your
out.
Twitter?
It just came out this year.
Yep. January.
Like, it's this, people, this is hot off. It is still smoking. You can see there is steam coming off this book right now as I speak. I'm not bullshitting y'all. Y'all need to get this book because if you're really talking about making content, if you're really talking about learning and trying to be up to date with shit, you need to get this book because I'm like, when I leave here today, mm-hmm. I'm going to be curled up. I'm going to finish the last two episodes of Marcella. I'm going to make my cappuccino and I'm going to get into here. He's got Crackle. He's got Fox. He's got every business model, and I think it's so important, especially the fact that we do this podcast mm-hmm. is to give people information, right. especially those of you guys who are listening overseas. Real shit. And you know I'm a fan of overseas stuff and people who are not from the United States. I want to see your shit. Mm-hmm. And if this book is going to help you get your content out there so I can like go into the dark net mm-hmm. and try to find somebody and like get this. Please get this book.
That's what's
you can get it online, Amazon. I think you get it on Kindle. Can you get it on Kindle for
them too?
You can get it on Kindle.
You can get it at barnesandnoble.com. I mean, pretty much everywhere.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just brick and mortar bookstores. Okay. I mean, some of them, specialty shops are coming back, but it's a different world
right.
now.
Right.
Know? So, Neil, you're on Twitter.
I'm on Twitter. I think it's Neil Land.
Wait, what do you mean you think?
That well, means, I am on Twitter. That means he tweets like, once every month.
Neil Land is my N-E-I-L-L-A-N-D. Or I tend to use Facebook a lot more than Twitter.
Okay.
I don't know why, but it's right. probably just, you know.
Where you at, Lisa? Lisa Colt, Jane.
Oh, y'all know I'm on Twitter.
Here, this is. So let me know what you think of the
Yes, definitely, definitely.
How to reach me.
I will definitely and, tweet it out.
Yeah, tweet about
And let people know and take a bunch of notes and stuff. But yeah, folks, you can always find me on Twitter. I'm either hanging out with all the homies, all the nerdy folks on Saturday Night Sci-Fi, Friday Night Horror, whenever Black Girl Nerds has like a 90s live tweet, 80s live mm-hmm. tweet. You can find me at BitchFlix, even though I haven't written in a while. BitchFlix. BitchFlix, fam. I'm writing. I really am. I've just been busy like just writing scripts and, you know, my female pimp. Mm-hmm. Script. I'm actually trying to turn it into a pilot TV show.
Oh, good idea.
Because I realized that the shit I was trying to tell in that script, a lot of this new shit that's happening right now in the world in terms of sex and how to make your money with sex and sex workers, I think in my female pimp is going to mm-hmm. have to, the old script title is Bitches Brew, because you know Miles Davis here. But, you know, I've been working. So expect some new stuff on BitchFlix. And then, of course, check me out. I'll be in New Orleans in August because I'm writing a horror script with my girl, Jaretta. So if you're down in New Orleans, I know the Essence Fest is happening, you know, so. Hey, always hit me up on Twitter. In the old days, I would tell people don't follow me because I talk about everything. And sometimes people get their feelings hurt.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm embracing my ratchetness.
See what I got to deal with?
My sophister ratchetness. That's in the world.
I like it.
But please, fam, make sure you get this book. It's important stuff. And I think it's something that's going to help us become better writers.
True. That's what's up. And I'm your host, Hilliard Guest. Thank you again, Neil. We appreciate
my
having
pleasure.
You.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Happy you guys can find me on Twitter. I say Twitter like I'm British or something.
Twitter.
You guys can find me on Twitter. Shut up.
Twitter.
Be looking at me like that.
Twitter.
You find me on Twitter at Hilliard Guest.
Me and my mates.
You guys can find me, find the show, Screenwriters RR on Twitter. Please follow us, share, tweet, all that other shit like that. If you guys have any questions, screenwritersrentroom@gmail.com. Please go on and give us a 5-star review on iTunes, because we need that for The Matrix, stuff like that. So everybody joining me for 2016. You'll know when it comes in. So on this show, we keep it real. Mm. We keep it opinionated. We keep it what, everybody?
2016. Wait, Neil's lip syncing over there.
Like, yeah. Did he turn into a Muppet on us or some shit? Peace, y'all.
Ciao.
Let the beast about the cage, that light about the dark. Can you build the inferno from an itty bitty spark? Coffee shop hustlers rise with the cream. A million other writers, same Hollywood dream. Your pen and paper all like bullets in the gun. Write what you feel, say what you want. In the red room, we say what we say, we do what we feel. We gotta keep it real.
In the red room,
all about the crap.
So look, if you guys are grown, let's go ahead and get in. Mm-hmm.